This is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Welcome to this week's A Big Picture. Jim is going on the record, which we do periodically here on the show, where we try to address issues you raise in your emails. This one is a curious one of mine because there are investing programs out there, Jim, automated investment programs like Betterment. There are others out there. What do you think of those? How well do they work? Are there hazards or dangers? Just general overview on that.
Well, I mean, they have their place, John, and it really depends on what you're looking at. And I think they're very effective, especially for a young couple starting out. I mean, if we take a look at the three legs of most retirement plans, in the past, they've been things like pension plans, Social Security, and savings. Well, we know what's happened to pension plans. Unless you work for the government, a lot of the defined benefit pension plans that existed in this country after World War II, most of that has been shifted over to what we call defined contribution plans, which is today's 401k plan, 403b, or 457 plans. But what corporations did is they said, this is too expensive. So they shifted over the burden for retirement planning over to the individual. And so a very important leg of retirement planning has been removed. So that leaves Social Security. And as we've seen over the decades, it used to be free. Then they taxed 50% of it. Then they taxed 85%. And I can tell you, I don't care whoever the next president is, we're going to be facing entitlement reforms because the government is going to be running out of money. So we've seen the shift in Medicare, where under George W. Bush, Medicare premiums went up threefold, depending on your income. We've seen under Obamacare where more of the cost of medical is being shifted over to the individual. So that's an upcoming trend. So that leaves the third segment for planning for retirement, which is savings. Where I think these automated investment programs can come in handy, you take a young couple that is starting out in life. It sort of, you can say, all right, I want to retire at X amount of age. I want to have this kind of income. And it basically tells you what you need to be putting aside, how you should be investing given your age. So, John, I think they have a lot of merit to them, and especially for, let's say, a younger couple. I think, however, as you build your net worth, as your career progresses, then I think they become less valid. In fact, there was a study, which we're going to discuss on lifetime income on Monday, which was the efficacy of publicly available retirement planning tools. And they basically said they're far and lacking. And in fact, many ways, they can be dangerous, giving people false perceptions, because any kind of effective retirement plan, and especially once you start accumulating any semblance of wealth, whether it's in a 401k, equity in your home, should incorporate four major factors: age, your current age, your target age for retirement, and also something very important is your life expectancy. Other factors like current income. What's your current income now? What's going to be your future source of income in inflation-adjusted terms? Assets, what you have now, what you're going to have in the future. And John, also what I call rates, the rate of return on investments, the rate of return on inflation, what inflation rates are, and tax rates. And what we all know is inflation rates have changed over the last decade, as well as tax rates. They came down under Reagan. They went up under Clinton. They came down under Bush. They went up under Obama. So one thing that is for sure is death and taxes. And we know taxes are more likely to change in the future. So answer to your question, I think these automated investment programs are a good starting point. They're better than nothing for somebody to start out. It sort of gives you an idea that this is your current age. Let's say you're a young couple out of college, you're 25, you're starting a family, and you want to retire at age 66 or 65. This is the money you should be putting aside. And more importantly, given your age bracket, how you should be invested. And if you follow it, it gives you sort of a bit of a roadmap. But I think it's effective in that sense, but I think once you start accumulating any sort of semblance of wealth, once again, you know, equity in your home or a portfolio, then I think it's more important that you get a professional plan that incorporates all the things I mentioned. But John, for somebody starting out versus not having anything at all, I think there's a place for them. The trouble is, as we all know, if you take a look at the world that we live in today, think of how taxes have changed, think of how the investment markets have changed. We've seen all kinds of things that are making it much more difficult. And the biggest trend going forward is the government is going to unload a lot more of its responsibilities. I don't care if it's medical care to Social Security, more onto the individual as they back away from promises they made that they can no longer keep. So in that sense, starting out early with savings, we've talked about this a number of times, a lifetime income, that I forget what the figure was. We did a show that if you take a look at matching contributions, and I think it was tax benefits, a couple today only needs to save a couple $100 a month to have $1 million at age 65. So obviously, the sooner you get started, the more appropriately you invest. In other words, if you're starting out at age 25, you should be in equities and growth and not worry about the stock market, what it's doing today, or what we're worried about, what the Fed is doing. What you care about is what you're going to have 40 years from now when you get ready to retire. So automated investment plans have a place. I think they're better than no plan at all, but they have a lot of restricted limitations. And as the recent study coming out of the Texas University, their efficacy is lacking when you're talking about long-term planning. But as a starting point for somebody that is young, starting out in life, I think they're very appropriate.
If you've been watching the presidential debates, what is interesting is the lack of discussion about how we're going to service what will be a $20 trillion debt when the next president comes into office. There's a lot of discussion about giveaways and other tax issues and sometimes maybe a little budgetary stuff, but not very much. Nevertheless, of course, the policies of the government have an impact upon the economy, and we should probably look at who the two leading contenders now are, having made it through Super Tuesday. That would be former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And let's compare their projected fiscal policies and see what we think the impacts might be. People want to know.
Well, I mean, this is an election year, and we did a show on this a couple of weeks back. In an election year, politicians are out kissing babies, handing out lollipops, and a lot of free stuff. And, you know, if you're looking at somebody and say, hey, if I'm elected, I'm going to give you free health care, I'm giving you free college, I'm going to give you free this, it sells. It's very popular. But as we talked about a couple of weeks ago, and we've looked at this rather extensively, and it's not just us, there have been economists that have looked at these plans. Here's the problem. You mentioned right off the bat, John, the next president is going to take office with $20 trillion of national debt. Now, so far, the government's been able to get away with that large amount of debt because something we'll address later on, which is financial repression. Here's the problem. We're going to have $20 trillion of debt. Now, here's the amazing fact. In 2008, the government spent $450 billion on interest expense on the debt at that time, which was $10 trillion. Fast forward to where we are today, the government's fiscal year ending in 2015, which would have been last September, the interest on the national debt has fallen by $50 billion, even though the national debt has gone up by $9 trillion, and that's because of financial repression. So think of this. For every 1% increase in interest, the deficit goes up and interest expense goes up by $200 billion. Now, if we were to normalize from 2% interest rates to 5, which has been more of the norm over the last 4 or 5 decades, the interest the government would have to pay on the national debt would be $1 trillion alone, which is $600 billion more than what we're spending today. So all of these promises that the government is making, especially on, let's say, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders about free medical, free this, all this free stuff. Let's look at the reality. If you take Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, interest on the debt, you're talking about 70% of the government's budget. Add in defense, you're talking about 90%, which means there's only 10% left to run the government. And that's not talking about any increase in interest rates. So this reality that we're talking about here, that, you know, we're just going to raise tax rates. I'm trying to think who the comedian did a spoof on this, where basically he said, why don't we just take everybody's wealth? We'll take it from football players, entertainers. We'll take it from Bill Gates, Warren Buffett. You would run the government for about 1 year. So even if you confiscated everything as they do in, let's say, a communist type system, which is what Sanders is in favor of, you would run the government for about a year.
That was actually Bill Whittle. And he said by the end of the year, he went through this about who they were taking it from and how much. And he said, yep, we got to December 31st. We balanced the budget and we have completely wrecked the economy.
Yeah, it was Bill Whittle, because he basically said, all right, let's just go after rich people. We'll go after the movie stars. We'll go after professional athletes. We'll go after, you know, the super rich like Warren Buffett and Bill Gates. We'll just take it all. I mean, we'll just confiscate it. You would run the government for about a year. So the reality is, the problem is, the press has done a very poor job of educating the American public. So when you see somebody up there that says, hey, if you vote for me, I'm going to give you a whole bunch of free stuff, and we're just going to make somebody else pay for it. Folks, it doesn't work. I mean, take a look at Venezuela's economy. Take a look at what China used to be before they moved more towards an open capitalistic system. Look what Russia used to be. Or look at what happened to some of those countries in Africa or South America, the mess that they're in. I mean, take a look at the unemployment rate in Europe. Under socialism, it's 11%. In countries like Spain and Portugal, in Italy, it's over 20%. Is that really what we want? I mean, the reality is this country is going to have $20 trillion of debt. And right now, the government is barely paying over 2%. I think the average on all of the debt, 60% of the debt is public and 40% of the debt is owed to itself. In other words, money that they owe the Social Security Highway Trust Fund, because they take the money out of the trust fund and stick an IOU there. So, but even then, the realities are going to be that 90% of the government's budget is spoken for with entitlements and defense. So you're only talking about 10%. So what are you going to do? Get rid of government? That's not going to work. So the realities are, John, the economics just don't add up. And the reality is, it'll either be forced upon the next president or they will do it voluntarily. But we're going to have entitlement reform. And as we talked about the first subject, the reality is, just as corporations have shifted a lot of the burden for retirement planning from defined benefit plans to defined contribution plans, you're going to see more and more of that for government. Right now, there was a study done. In the next financial crisis, like a recession, there are only 13 states in this country out of 50 that have enough money to carry unemployment claims, not to mention unfunded pension liabilities. The way of the defined benefit pension plan for government, I hate to tell you, is the next thing that's going to go. There just isn't the money to pay for it. And a lot of cities and states are going broke trying to pay for it, including my own state of California. So the reality is, the next recession is going to force a fiscal crisis on government. And I don't care who the president is, but this notion that we're going to get a whole bunch of more free stuff, free medical, free college, free this, free that. One candidate wants 3 months paid for leave from work if you need it, like a sabbatical. I mean, that's not reality. It's not going to work. Hasn't worked in Russia, didn't work in China. It isn't working in Venezuela. It's not working in Latin America. And look at the mess that Europe's in. And you think that that it didn't work in those places, somehow our guys are a lot smarter and they'll make it work here? The reality is, we have too much debt. And I don't care who the president is, whether it's going to be Trump or Clinton, they're going to be faced with the reality of $20 trillion in national debt. And that's why I think the press should do a better job of educating the American public and saying, your program wants to do this, how are you going to pay for it? And then question their assumptions on how they're going to pay for it, because the numbers aren't there. They don't add up.
Yeah, but remember, as David Horowitz would say, it's a politics is all about power. It has nothing to do with the truth, you know. It has to do with what you can sell and how well you can fight in the media. The other thing, though, is when the debt comes out, I mean, when it finally hits a point where the reneging has to continue. I think it's already begun. I call it the great reneging. But then that's a hard sell to the public. See, this creates shockwaves in the political system. Look what happened in Greece. Greece is a perfect microcosm of the whole thing. Suddenly, you mean we have to pay for all the stuff we've been doing over the past, four decades or something? We don't want to do that. And then the blame game starts as to who's responsible. And then you have the politicians who posture and say, we're not going to do that. We're going to stand our ground and refuse to do it. Well, we see how that worked in Greece, too. You know, so anyway, one of the things you talk about a lot here on the program is financial repression. And it's a mechanism that I don't think people understand. Inflation is somewhat easy to understand, but repression is something a little different. So maybe we ought to look at that and why it tends to mask inflation. In reality, it's still transferring wealth, but it's different.
Well, I mean, it's a way or a means for government to handle and inflate away its debt. And believe it or not, this sort of policy has been around since the Great Depression. It was one of the ways the United States worked off its debt load following World War II, because debt levels for the government were very large. And what financial repression attempts to do is it puts a cap or ceiling on interest rates. And who's the big beneficiary of a cap on interest rates? It certainly isn't savers. If you're out there and you have money in a money market fund, you have money in a bank, I mean, think of what you're getting today compared to what you got 7 or 8 years ago. And it does this through monetary policy. It does it through regulations. It creates a captive domestic audience. I mean, you take a look at part of the regulations that came from Dodd-Frank were requiring banks to shore up their balance sheets by owning government debt. So they become a captive buyer. And so what financial repression does is through monetary policy and government regulations, it caps interest rates. Now, earlier, I talked about the realities of the national debt. And here's a good example of a beneficiary of financial repression. Because 8 years ago, the government had $9 trillion less debt than it has today. And yet, interest on the national debt 8 years ago was $450 billion. Today, interest on the national debt is $400 billion, even though the government has $9 billion more in debt. And the way the government is able to do this is the Fed buys the government bonds. And if you take a look at, I'm just going to call a screen here, of where interest rates are on short-term government securities. I mean, a one-month treasury bill pays 0.25%. A one-year treasury bill pays less than 0.7%. A seven-year treasury note pays 1.7%. A 10-year note, notes are, interest rates are backing up as the market's going up, but a 10-year treasury note is 1.9%. So as interest rates are artificially kept low, and that's what they are, and you think it's bad here, folks, it's much worse overseas, where actually you pay the government for them borrowing money from you. So rates are actually negative. So the whole purpose of financial repression is to cap the level of debt, the interest rate that the government has to pay, and gradually inflate that debt away over time. In other words, as inflation creates higher asset values, that debt becomes a lower percentage of GDP in the economy. And this is what we did. Believe it or not, we pursued this in 1951, where the Fed kept interest rates artificially low for almost two decades until the 70s, when we had runaway inflation. They could no longer cap it. And if you think they can't do it, take a look at Japan. Japan has had 0% interest rates. They're negative now. That's been going on in Japan for two decades. So this has altered dramatically not only investment markets, it distorts investment markets because you don't have market forces determining true interest rates. And so what happens is money is chasing all kinds of assets around the globe looking for a good rate of return. And that money is typically going into more riskier assets. And so financial repression is the government's tool to inflate away its debt. So if you're looking at low interest rates now and you've been there for 8 years, maybe you're sitting in a money market fund or cash, the bad news is this is going to go on for a lot longer period of time. We had Dr. Gary Schilling on here, I think it was about a month ago. They interviewed him, and he wrote a book about the new normal, basically about the low economic growth and low interest rates that we are facing today. And he thought that would last for about 10 years. It started in 2008, so we're about 8 years into it. But when I recently interviewed him, he thought that the financial period of repression would last another decade. So, folks, if you don't like low interest rates now, get used to it, because coming up next may be negative interest rates. Think of those people in Europe and Japan where actually there was an article in the Wall Street Journal when Japan implemented negative interest rates about a month ago. There is a shortage of safes. People are saying, I'm not going to pay the bank to keep my money there. I'll just keep it in cash and keep it in a safe at home. And so they're not having the effect that they want in terms of negative interest rates. But financial repression is a policy that benefits government. It's going to be here for a lot longer period of time. So get used to it. It's going to be a tough market to operate from an investment perspective, trying to get a return. I mean, the old days when you got 5 or 6% on money market funds, you could get 6, 7% in a bond. And it's interesting. I just interviewed this week Nobel laureate Robert Merton from Harvard University. And he was talking about how this is distorted. And he was saying that today people talk about, you know, purchasing power, maintaining your principal or the value. And he talked about that's not the way to look at things. And the best example he gave is something we've used here on the program. If you had $1 million in 2000 and you wanted safe investments, I could have put you in government bonds, getting you a 6 or 7% rate of return. So on $1 million, you would get anywhere from $60,000 to $70,000. If I was to put you in a 1 year treasury bill today on $1 million, you would get $6,700 of interest versus $60,000 to $70,000 of interest. And that's the best example I can give you of how financial repression works. It's here and it's going to be here for a period of time. So you need to take that into account if you're investing today, saving for retirement. And that's why I still like the stock market as a, or real estate as a long-term builder of wealth versus keeping money in cash, because cash is eroding in value, which is the purpose of financial repression, is to inflate the debt away.
Okay, next question is, I know you've been a long-time proponent of dividend-paying stocks. Things are changing right now. If we're going into recession, we notice the mechanics of the market have changed since the beginning of the year. Do dividends still work?
Well, absolutely. I mean, we did a show on this, and I've been a proponent of dividend investing now for about 4 or 5 years, and a lot of it has to do with financial repression. You know, for the first time, I've been in this business, 36 years now? And for the first time in my investment career, the yield on dividends is actually higher than what you can get in treasuries. And that is a big sea change. You would have to go back to the early 50s, early 60s, the last time we saw dividends yielding higher than what you could get in the bond market. And a lot of that, once again, has to do with the previous subject we talked about, is financial repression. The problem is, John, what is the government trying to do? They're trying to inflate away the debt. If you think of, I don't know, the things that you pay for on a day-to-day basis, the basic necessities, your health insurance, which is going up at high single digits, you know, buying a new car, your utilities, your phone bill, your cell phone bill, your insurance, food, things, college costs, the things that you need to spend on a daily basis, they keep going up. And how are you going to pay for that? I mean, how are you going to enjoy a lifestyle if you don't have either a source of income, let's say your wages, if you were a salaried employee, or a business that has the ability to raise, let's say it's selling cost or services? How are you going to pay for that? How are you going to keep up with inflation? And that's one thing a business has the ability to do. And especially good businesses that have a protective moat, have a high return on equity, that have the ability to raise the prices on the services they offer or their products that they make, so that over time their profits grow, as their sales grow, and as that happens, their cash flow grows, and they're able to return a dividend to you and raise that dividend each year. I mean, that's the only reason to me to invest in the stock market. I mean, if I just wanted something fixed that never went up, I'd be better off in a bond, a fixed bond, where I know what the rate of return is. The purpose of being in the stock market is you want appreciation of assets, the asset value of the stock, and appreciation of income. And I think one of the things that has been lost over time, and it really happened, I think, in the 90s, when we went through the technology boom and stocks were going up 20% a year. But if you look at historical studies, when anybody tells you the stock market has returned 10% over a long period of time, 45% to 50% of that return has come from dividends. And when you're reinvesting those dividends and looking at longer periods of time, 10-year periods, 15, 20, 30-year periods, the dividend becomes the most significant portion of the rate of return. There was a book that was written. This came out in 2002. It was called Triumph of the Optimist, 101 Years of Global Investment Returns. And what these professors did, they took a look at rates of return on assets over an extended period of time and the effect of dividends. And what it did is it took a look at what would have happened had you invested a dollar in 1900, what would it have grown to by the year 2000? If you invested $1 in the year 1900, by the year 2000, with compounding, that dollar grew to $198. However, and this was investing in the stock market, if you reinvested with the dividends, the rate of return increased substantially. Instead of $1 that you would have had, growing to $198 with reinvestment of dividends, at $1 would have grown to $16,797. So the longer the period of time that you have to invest, the more powerful force that dividend investing makes. In fact, that's where you get this number. You hear people throw out numbers like the stock market has returned 10.1% over a period of time. The wealth effect is 85 times larger with dividends. I mean, you take a look at $198 versus $16,797, and that right there, I need not say anything more about the powerful impact of dividends. So yes, John, I think dividends are a very, very important focus for long-term investing. And if you're not investing in dividend stocks, I think you're making a big mistake.
And you're listening to The Big Picture right here on the Financial Sense News Hour, where today Jim's going on the record, and we'll have more to come as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour, featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
In today's interview, we pick up where we left off yesterday with Ron Stoferle on his new book, addressing Austrian economics and a number of other fascinating insights. One of the things, and you mentioned this when you were talking about the first element, hoarding, that, you know, we see this trend towards negative interest rates now in Europe and Japan. And, you know, some are even saying that we might see that in the US as well at some point. Given that's the case, it's quite troubling when you think about it, that trying to earn return on one's capital, and typically long-term government bonds or just government bonds in general, have been one of the main vehicles for people to save and earn a return on their savings. And now at this point, when you see negative interest rates, that incentive is no longer there. And instead, most of the argument being made for why you would want to hold bonds that are at negative rates is because of the capital appreciation component if they go more negative. Now, to me, that's quite disturbing because you've now taken a traditionally long-term investment, which is used as a vehicle for savings, and you're now incentivizing a large group of investors out there to use it instead as something for saving and now for something to be speculated with. What are your thoughts on that?
First of all, you know, the whole interest rate situation with Japan introducing negative rates, the Eurozone, also Switzerland and Sweden, for example, I think this is a very disturbing trend. And we always said already last year that sooner or later, the Federal Reserve will implement negative rates as well. And I think that we are on the verge of entering a recession in the US. We're actually writing a chart book about that and showing some really interesting charts why we think that the US might enter recession soon. From my point of view, you know, central bankers are running out of ammunition because they already lowered interest rates after the GFC. They implemented quantitative easing. Of course, there is decreasing or diminishing marginal utility when it comes to quantitative easing. So QE4 will have to be, I don't know, 150 billion per month or even more, and lead to higher boom bust cycles. And of course, there will be even more interventions by central banks. And that makes me really nervous about the future of the financial system, but also a bit of society.
Welcome back to The Big Picture. Today, we have a series of topics that Jim is addressing based on emails we receive from listeners. You know, one of the ones that we always hear about is gold. Gold took a big bump recently based on everything that's going on. In the first decade of the new century, you were pretty bullish on gold. Then it switched. And where do you think gold is headed now?
I really think, as our technician, Tom McClone, in the first hour, and then Ned Schmidt were talking about gold, I think whenever you look at a chart and something breaks out of a long-term downtrend, as gold is doing now, it's signifying a sea change. And I think that sea change, John, is what Martin Armstrong often has talked about, the end of confidence in government. And according to Armstrong, confidence peaked in government last October. The markets are now starting to question the efficacy of monetary policy. And I think what it's recognizing is in this rate cycle, you know, when the Fed began talking about raising interest rates with the taper, which began in 2013, it was originally looked at that they were going to raise interest rates in the 4%, 4.5% range. Since they first began talking about 4.5%, that's come down to 2.5%. And there are many right now that don't even think they get to 1%. And if they stop after this quarter point, or maybe there's one more increase, it will be the shortest rate raising cycle in the history of monetary policy since World War II. And so that's what I think the gold market is telling us. It needs a catalyst. And that catalyst is a loss, in my opinion, in confidence in government. Gold is not a supply and demand situation. When you think about gold today, every ounce of gold that has ever been produced in the world still exists, unlike silver, which is consumed. So theoretically, at a higher price of gold, there's an unlimited supply because that gold that has been produced still exists in the world. Now, granted, religious artifacts and things like that are not going to be melted down, but a lot of gold that is sitting on the sidelines or in inventory could be melted down, jewelry, or even coins come into the market because all that gold still exists. So gold isn't really a question about supply and demand. It's really about the value of money. And that's what you need to understand when you're looking at the gold market. And especially now, as we move more and more to negative interest rates, gold does very well in a market of negative interest rates. And a good example was the recent Wall Street Journal article talking about Japan, which implemented negative interest rates about a month ago. And what are the people of Japan doing? They're saying, I'm not going to leave my money in the bank. Why would I do that and pay the bank to have my money on deposit? I'm just going to get myself a safe and keep my money, stick it in a mattress or stick it in a safe. They interviewed a couple of people who are saying, you know what? I'm thinking of buying some gold. And what you're seeing here with these negative interest rates is devaluation, the debasement of currencies. That, to me, is the story that gold is signaling to the market right now, is the coming devaluation of money, as Ned Schmidt and I talked about with the dollar in the first hour. So now I think we're having an end game, which we'll get into with central banks, as the markets and the more smart money begins to look at and saying, wait a minute, you know, they're running out of tricks to do things. I mean, you know, the Fed, let's put it this way. It took them almost a year to stop tapering and the money printing. It took them a whole year just to raise interest rates a quarter of a point. And even now, they can't come out definitively and say, no, we're going to do this in March, and we're going to raise it in March, we're going to raise it in June. What are they telling you? We're data dependent. We don't know what we're going to do because we don't know what the data is going to be. And that's what I think what the gold market is starting to sniff out is the end game for central banks and the coming currency devaluations. Because when you get into a deflationary environment, very much like we had in the 30s, it can be stopped overnight with devaluation, which was the first thing that Roosevelt did within his first weeks in office. He devalued the dollar by 40%, got rid of deflation, and we had inflation until they messed things up again in 1937. So, John, I think gold is entering a favorable uptrend. You know, is it going to explode overnight? No. But gold is responding to monetary shifts. And right now, there's a tectonic shift going on with central banks around the world as they pursue negative interest rates and zero rates. And I think that's what the gold market is now beginning to sniff out. So I think that is what the gold market is signaling, because once again, gold is not a supply and demand situation, because every ounce of gold that ever existed still exists today and is a potential source of supply at the right price.
What is a person to do is often the question you hear. The next question is, what do you read? I mean, because there are so many data points out there, Jim, a lot of times these things are contradictory. How do you separate noise from substance and organize it into something you believe to be true?
You know, I spend, first thing I do when I get up in the morning and probably the last thing I do before I stop in the evening is I'm on the internet. I subscribe to a lot of online publications, newsletters, papers. It's amazing. We talked about 10 trends that are going away. You know, I read the Wall Street Journal. I read the Financial Times. I read Fortune. I read Business Week. You know, those are standard things that I read, but a lot of the things I get are off my Bloomberg. I get Bloomberg briefs, which are quite extensive. And then we subscribe to a lot of independent research. And what I suggest you do, the listener, and one thing that we've always tried to do, is I always try to get thoughts from people I disagree with. In other words, if I believe in inflation, I want to hear what the deflationists are saying. If I'm bullish on the stock market, I want to hear about or read somebody that's bearish on the stock market and weigh the balance. The problem is today, people tend to read the same things that agree with their own viewpoints, and they don't get alternative sources of views or opinions, which is why many times they make a lot of investment mistakes. And so I try to read as much as I can. And I also read globally, because I think one of the problems is the U.S. has a very restrictive media. Most of the major newspapers are owned by just a few corporate hands. One of my clients mentioned this when they were traveling, and this gentleman does a lot of traveling. As he goes across the country and he's in the airport picking up the local newspaper, he finds out the stories are all the same, and they usually are. And John, you and I know this, that the news in this country is repressed. We don't tell, and they suppress certain news that they don't want people to see or know about. So if you really want to know what's going on in the United States, it's also very helpful to get the perspective of what foreigners think. So I always like to subscribe to foreign publications and get their viewpoints in terms of economics and the markets on the United States, as well as get also newsletters that I subscribe to that are from opinions that I don't necessarily agree with, but also I think that are valid opinions and have good points, because sometimes it gets you to think differently. Like you might think of some, gee, I never thought about that. And so that's what I like to do. And I would really encourage you to start reading books, because the problem, we live in this soundbite world today where everything is trying to be synthesized into a few soundbites on Twitter, Instagram, all these things that we have out there that are short term, and you really can't do any in-depth analysis or in-depth provocative or even deep thinking in a short article. I mean, newspapers are great, but they're not going to cover a subject matter in depth the way you can when you interview an author that took maybe years to research a subject. Right now, I'm reading a new biography on Napoleon, that's probably the best book I ever read. And the author, I didn't realize this, John, I think in his career, Napoleon wrote over 36,000 letters. This guy took 3 years reading all of Napoleon's correspondence. And it's probably one of the best books I ever read on Napoleon as a historical figure, because it really gives you an in-depth view. That's what you're going to get when you read a book. I mean, my favorite routine, I don't do it as much as I used to, but my favorite thing to do on Saturday morning was to go down to the local Barnes & Noble store. They had a coffee shop. I'd have my coffee. I would peruse the magazine racks. I mean, I do that maybe once a month now, where I used to do it every week, because right now I simply go on Amazon. I take a look at publications. I look at new books out. If I want it, I just press a button, and a couple days later, it's on my doorstep. If I don't want to wait, I just fire up my Kindle, press a button, and 2 minutes later, I'm reading it on my Kindle. So, you know, try to read as much as you can from varied sources, but also take the time to read a book on a subject matter that you're interested in, you want to know more, because you're going to get that knowledge and in-depth understanding when you read a book. You can't get that in a short soundbite or a one-page article in the newspaper, or for that matter, a one-page article in the magazine. Really read a book. I mean, most of my knowledge and the things that have helped me throughout my career have come from books that I read, including, I mentioned, Gary Shilling's book. I think his book, Deflation Ready or Not, came out in 1982. And you got to remember, the consensus of thinking back then, I got in this business around 1979, 1980. We were coming off 14% inflation, $40 oil, $800 gold, $50 silver. And here was this guy saying, no, folks, the market environment is changing, and we're heading into a disinflationary environment. That changed my whole investment perspective and the way I invested for my clients in the 80s, just as his most recent book, The Age of Deleveraging, written in 2010, really talked about the new normal that we see today. Anemic economic growth, 0% interest rates, and low levels of inflation. And so I got that from a book. I didn't get that from a magazine or reading, you know, a newspaper article. So that's kind of what I do.
Well, it's always the subject of cash. You were talking about negative interest rates and people saying we're going to take our money out of the banks and put it in a safe somewhere. We'll keep it there. We've talked about cash as far as investments. Not a big proponent of that. I'm assuming that hasn't changed very much.
Not now. I mean, I was more so as a portion for part of your portfolio, maybe, let's say, 2 years ago when we had short-term interest rates, especially in the corporate world. I mean, you got to remember, a couple of years ago, Intel and Apple were issuing five-year notes at interest rates of 1.4% to 1.6%. So the corporate bond market wasn't very attractive to us. Today, we can get 4 or 5% on 1 and 2 year corporate bonds. That is certainly a lot more appealing to me as a rate of return. I mean, I recently moved about 25% of our pension plan, my own pension plan, into corporate bonds because I'm getting yields, you know, some of the best yields that I've seen in almost a decade. So, and the nice thing about short-term corporate bonds is two things. Number one, as we get closer and closer to a recession, you're going to see two things happen. As you get closer to a recession, risk begins to increase in the marketplace, because you go into a recession, what happens to companies? Their sales go down, their profits go down. So what happens to rating agencies? They start lowering the credit rating of corporations. Another thing that happens is investors begin demanding a higher rate of interest. And so as you do that, interest rates begin to climb. So we're keeping our debt in 1 to 2 year maturities where we're getting 4 or 5%. And we think those rates will even go higher. For example, last year, the notes that we did that were a year old, we were getting 2.5 to 3%. We're rolling them over this year. And now we're getting 4 and 5%. And as we get closer to recession, we may be getting 5 to 6% or even more. So we like that. And then we know if we go into recession, we're probably going to have a bear market. So maybe the bonds that we buy 2 years from now, we may be in a full-fledged bear market where the stock market loses 30-40%. And it would be nice to have that money roll over, get a nice rate of return, 4-5% in the meantime. And then when that money rolls over, you know, maybe we'll be in a bear market and we'll be able to pick up stocks at a lower price with a higher dividend yield. So that's why we like bonds right now, John, because the opportunity is there that didn't exist, let's say 2 years ago, where it does exist today. And I love the corporate bond area because I don't like sovereigns right now, because most of the sovereign debt in this world, if you're looking at Europe, if you're looking at Japan, interest rates are negative. And if you look at here in the U.S., I'm sorry, folks, but you know, a one-year treasury note at 0.6% just isn't attractive to me. I'd rather be making 4% than 0.6%. So we like corporate bonds, and that's why I like it better than cash, because cash was probably a better investment a couple of years ago, given where interest rates were in bonds. But now what's happened with where the economy's heading, because I think eventually we're going to be in a recession either next year, late next year, or in 2018. But we feel highly confident that we're going to see a recession here in the next 2 years, which means corporate bond yields will be rising. We keep our yields short, we're going to be getting a higher yield. It'll better position us to take advantage of not only higher interest rates, but also of the stock market if we get into a bear market.
Well, it's been a slow judgment call, but I think you probably believe that there is a recession in the cards. More and more people seem to be looking at that. What do you think?
You know, I really do think that sooner or later, we're going to head into a recession. I mean, the Atlanta Fed said that if you take a look at the way they measure it, we've had almost 300 basis points of tightening by the Fed. If you think of the impact of the dollar, if you take a look at what's going on with the economy, whether it's happening to our exports, our manufacturing sector, and the anemic growth rate as interest rates begin to climb higher, because a couple of things are going to happen. As the dollar has risen by 28% against most major currencies, what has that done? It's impacted the companies that make up the Dow Jones Industrial Average, 30 big companies. They're all international in scope of business. It's done the same thing with the S&P 500. And what happens as your sales begin to decline, as your profits begin to decline, because profits have already peaked. They peaked in the summer of 2014. The profits were down in the fourth quarter, and by indications of what companies said on their fourth quarter earnings, they'll probably be down in the first quarter. So we've already seen a peak in corporate profits. And eventually, as corporate profits begin to contract, what do companies do? They begin thinking about cutting cost. When they think about cutting costs, what does that mean? They begin to lay off workers. As workers begin to lay off, that's less spending power. And eventually, you get yourself into a recession. And that's the dangerous game that the Fed is playing. And it's why there's such a disparity in the futures market in terms of what's going to happen with interest rates and the economy and economic growth rates compared to what the Fed is projecting. And remember, the Fed has had to revise its interest rate plot and its economic growth rates every single year since this recovery began. So the Fed is usually wrong about 95% of the time. And as people from Jeffrey Gundlach to Ray Dalio at Bridgewater have said, is these blockheads are probably going to make a mistake again. And I think they are. And don't forget, by 2017, the full impact of Obamacare is going to hit this economy. Just as this year, you're going to see a tripling of the insurance premiums for people that do not pay for having a medical insurance program. They kept it low the first couple of years for election. But this year, when you file your 2016 tax return, April of 2017, you're going to get hit with almost $700 of healthcare premiums if you haven't bought a policy. Can you imagine the number of people working in this country that get hit with a $700 tax bill come next April? So there are a lot of things that are going to start hitting this economy. And that's why I think, John, a recession is in the cards. You know, politicians and the central bank would like to tell you they've repealed the business cycle. I have yet to see a business cycle that has been repealed.
Yeah, it was Stalin who wanted to see that cycle repealed, too, if you remember the Kondratiev cycles.
Didn't work very well, did it?
No, no matter how much he wanted to command it.
Yeah, and remember, John, going back in, what was it, 2006, Bernanke was talking about, oh, we'd never have a downturn in housing, and look what happened. So, I mean, just because the politicians tell you it's not going to happen, or you hear a Fed chairman say it's not going to happen, or Janet Yellen last time on Capitol Hill, she said 10% probability, don't believe it. These guys have not repealed the business cycle, just as we haven't repealed the different phases of the weather. You know, we haven't repealed summer or winter. We haven't repealed business cycles.
Okay, speaking of cycles, we seem to have the central banks trying to prop up this game. They're being pushed back into negative territory. And the real question is, how long can you keep this whole game going that they have been doing before disaster strikes in one form or another, or you have a series of crises?
Well, I mean, we're seeing this, and a lot of people are beginning to question central bank policy. And the problem that we have had with this administration is monetary policy works best when it's coupled with fiscal policy. And we've had the worst fiscal policy that I've seen since Jimmy Carter. I mean, we've had increased regulations, increased taxation, you know, the war on the coal industry, the energy industry. I've never seen the kind of regulations we've seen. I mean, even in my own business and my own broker dealer, we used to have two accounting firms to do our financial reports as a result of Dodd-Frank. Now we have five accounting firms. So the increase of cost of regulation, our health care premiums are up over 40%. So monetary policy, I mean, you can bring interest rates down to zero, but let's put it this way. If you're up to your eyeballs in debt as a homeowner, as a consumer, as a student, no bank's going to loan you money. So it doesn't matter that interest rates on treasury bills or savings deposits or home mortgages are the lowest they've been in over a half a century. If you can't get credit, you can't take advantage of those low interest rates. And so there's a limit to what central banks have done. And if you notice, and that's been happening as the level of debt has increased, and this is what the folks at Bank Credit Analysts call the debt supercycle, and they believe the debt supercycle is entering its final phase. The debt supercycle ended with consumers in the 2008 crisis. It's being extended right now by government debt. And we are in the final throes of the debt supercycle with government, where there's going to be a limitation as to the ability to government to borrow money without devaluing the currency. And that's why what we're doing right now is essentially financial repression, trying to keep a lid on those interest rates. So, John, we're getting to the end cycle of central banks. The end result when the next crisis hit will be a devaluation of all major currencies and a collapse of central bank policy, which will be, in my opinion, is we're heading towards a global central bank, which is what they've been working on, and more likely a global currency. But we're in the final phases of what we call the debt supercycle, which will probably be superseded by a global central bank sometime in the future, most likely the Bank of International Settlements or some organization like it.
What about a global currency per se?
You could very well see that. And the argument would be made, instead of all these currency devaluations and worrying about, you know, I got to hedge this currency or what's going to happen to this currency over here, the argument would be made, since the world is more integrated today on a global basis, that a global currency is more fitting given the trade flows of the world, the way it functions today economically, than these separate currencies. I mean, the arguments have already been made. It's just, you got to sell it to people. I mean, right now, the euro is not selling well. You're talking about a major decision coming in October, whether England remains in the EU. So it is not going well. You know, the French want to be French, the Brits want to be Brits, and Americans want to be Americans. So it's up to the politicians to try to sell the concept to the public of all the countries. But it's more likely that we're going to head in that direction with the next crisis, because it'll be a currency crisis, and it'll be a crisis related to government debt.
You know, one of the arguments that's always consistently being made is that high taxation is a way to prevent imbalance in wealth, and we forcibly remove it by process of taxation from people who are, quote, rich, and give it to people who need it, something on the other side. Now, that sort of goes against a whole bunch of economic principles, but Why is it that this progressive taxation, which invariably it winds up being, it's a stepped taxation, why is it really brutal on the middle class? I think we need to look at that, because I hear this argument all the time, Jim, and nobody looks at what it does.
Let's assume that you're successful. You go to school, you get a good education, you get a good paying job, you're successful in your career, you move up the ladder. As you do, you get promotions, your salary increases. As you go up, the government is going to take more and more what you make. Right now, the top tax rate on government is 44%. Now, it's 39.6 on the income tax rate. Then it's the phase out of deductions. It's the Obamacare Medicare tax that you got add on. All that is 44%. You take a state of California where the top income tax is 13.3. So you're already talking about 57% tax, not even counting what you pay on Social Security on the first $118,000 of what you make, which is 7.65 or 15.3 if you're self-employed. And you take a look at every place that there's been high taxation, John, what do you have is stagnation. And it's just simple. Why would you want to work if the more you work, the government takes more of it? And a good example is what we saw during the Great Depression. The rich stopped investing. They stopped, you know, guys like Joe Kennedy basically sat out the first part of the bear market in stocks in the Great Depression. He had his money invested in tax-free bonds and collecting tax-free checks. And it wasn't until the depths of the Depression in 1933 that he bought the Chicago Mart. And even though tax rates got up to 90-something percent, there were so many tax preference things that you could do to avoid taxes. I mean, when I got in this business as a financial planner, I paid Social Security taxes, but I didn't pay income taxes because that was back in the days of tax preferences and tax shelters. You know, in December, I'd compute what my income was, what my taxes were, and I'd get a 2-to-1, 3-to-1 tax shelter and zero out my taxes. That's what rich people did. If you were investing in real estate, there was no limitation in terms of the amount of money that you could write off from depreciation and expenses. I can remember a doctor that I had whose wife was in real estate, and this guy's making close to $3 million. Most of it was sheltered. So that's what happens when you raise tax rates to those levels. And take a look at what lower tax rates did with the Reagan era, as he brought tax rates from 70% down to eventually 28%, and they remained low for a considerable period of time. But John, you remember this during the Great Depression, it was very popular in Hollywood. You know, after $100,000, the government basically took over 90% of what you made. So the movie stars only made one picture. I mean, why would you want to make another picture and work for 4 or 5 months and the government takes 90%? It destroys the incentive. It removes the capital for businesses to reinvest. How does a business grow like Google or Apple or any major corporation? It grows through profits that are reinvested and expanded to grow the business. It's the same thing with individuals. Reverse or high taxation removes incentives. I mean, John, would you want to work if the government took 95% or 100% of what you made? Why would you want to work or expand your business or do anything and work harder if all of what you made went to the government and they confiscated it?
Right, because basically everybody acts in their own economic self-interest. And so you're just simply not going to want to do that. Why would you work for somebody else? But even for the middle class, Jim, this is the important part, is what people don't realize, is this puts a ceiling on the heights they can climb to, or it makes it much, much more difficult to get ahead, especially for what I call the producing class, those who provide the majority of the jobs in the country. So imagine this, you know, a skydiver jumps out of an airplane and the resistance of the air goes up as the square of the diver's speed. All right. And as a result of that, the faster he goes, the resistance increases as a multiplicity of, if he doubles his speed, it quadruples the resistance. So at some point, it stabilizes out, usually around 120 miles an hour, plus or minus stuff. But the point is from that point on, no matter how much gravity is involved, he isn't going to go any faster. And it's the same thing with this graduated form of income tax, is that the harder they work, the more they get ahead. Suddenly, boop! Everything they had just that they advanced to get ahead has just been taken from them. And that's why, you know, it sounds really good. Let's go tax the rich. Let's do this, blah, blah, blah. But in reality, it really affects the middle and lower classes more than anyone else.
Yeah, the rich, just like in the Great Depression when we had 90% tax rates, the rich were fine. They find ways to shelter and hide their income, and they didn't get to be rich by being stupid. And they're not going to sit there and say, okay, you can have 90% of what I have. That's just not the way the world works. So unless you were to go to a communist dictatorship like you had in the Soviet Union or in China at one time or in Cuba, it just doesn't work that way. And so that's why it destroys incentives. You know, it was amazing. There was a book written a couple years ago. In fact, it was by Hernan de Soto called The Wealth of Nations. And he was talking about why do you have wealthy nations and non-wealthy nations? And a good example is North Korea. Why is North Korea impoverished and South Korea wealthy? It has to do with free markets and it has to do with property rights. Start removing property rights and removing free markets and you impoverish a nation. And this was a study, and I'd like to recommend that you read this book because it'll give you some great insights as to explaining why you have wealthy nations and poor nations alike. And it goes a long way to explaining that. And that's what you have with high taxation.
Yeah, he was pointing out that in Peru, which is his home country, he compared what it takes to start a business, say, in the United States versus in Peru. And I think in Peru, there were something like 1,400 steps and things you had to grease to get a legitimate business going in Peru.
Not to mention bribes.
Well, I didn't want to bring that up, but it's really true in these countries that are impoverished. The bribe is a way of doing things. So he said then people are forced into a second category. It's not really a black market, but it's a black operation where they operate, but they just can't afford to be legitimate. And therefore, their guarantee of keeping the gains that they have is also in jeopardy, you know, as far as buying property with it and things of that nature. So this is very directly attached, and people don't understand why there's a Fourth Amendment to the Constitution, the right to be secure in your person, papers, and possessions. Otherwise, everything is put at risk. All right, 2016, with everything going on, not to mention that it's a silly season election year, how do you invest in 2016, given all the changes we've seen?
This is going to be a difficult year, as we talked about in our forecast at the beginning of the year. I think the first part of the year is going to be the more difficult part of the year. I think it'll be a little better in the second half. But, you know, right now, as I mentioned earlier, you know, we're looking at short-term corporate bonds in the 1 to 2 year range as sort of a substitute for cash because of the rate of return versus zero. We're looking at corporate merger arbitrage as one method of looking at stock market, and then also high dividend paying stocks and things that are stable, you know, telecoms, utilities, consumer staples, things like that. Although, you know, I have to say the energy sector is getting very, very interesting here in terms of especially what Ned Schmidt and I talked about in the first hour. So, John, I think this is going to be a transition year for investing over the next 2 years, because I do think eventually we're going to head into a recession and a bear market, and we could be facing zero or negative interest rates. So I would say this is more of a transitionary year for investments, I think, this year and next year. Although, if some of the technicians are right, I mean, Tom McClellan was talking about one more downturn where everybody just gives up on the stock market, and by summer, we could be on our way up to another bull market. Although, Tom did say that typically, as you get to October, and especially this year, being a presidential election, the markets are going to be reacting to what each proponent is saying. I mean, one candidate wants to raise taxes, regulation, more government spending. The other candidate, supposedly, the opposite. So, you know, we may have a lot more turmoil and volatility this year, given that it's an election year. We're still dealing with what the Fed's going to do. Are they going to raise or are they not going to raise? And so that's why I think in a transition year, you need to have a more flexible strategy. And that's what we're doing. We're using short-term corporate bonds. We're using stable-type high dividend payers. And then we're using merger arbitrage as a means of getting, you know, a halfway decent return in a transitionary period, which I think we're going to be in for at least this year and next year.
All right, that's it for On the Record today. Coming up later this month, we do have a Fed meeting, which I'm sure is going to attract everyone's attention, given all of the speculation about will they or won't they go up another quarter point or so in interest rates. And anything else, Jim?
Well, you know, speaking of that Fed meeting, it's going to be important, John, because number one, we'll have a press conference, and this will be the first meeting that the Fed updates its dot plot. In other words, where they see interest rates going, that's been steadily coming down over the years. And also they update their forecast for the economy interest rates and inflation. So that's a very important event coming up in March. And that will be in another week or two. And then probably towards the end of the month, we're going to be getting a glimpse at what first quarter earnings are based on what companies were telling us in the fourth quarter. I suspect that it'll be another downturn for earnings in Q1 versus, let's say, a year ago. You know, watch the economic numbers going forward. We just got the unemployment numbers for the month of February. It surprised the market. Employers added 242,000 jobs. The job unemployment rate stood at 4.9%. So as we talked about the LEIs last weekend on the program, they were sort of mixed, but there were some subtle nuances that they were ticking upward, and that was certainly supported by February's unemployment number. But I would say economics, the Fed, and probably later on in the month, anybody that's got some bad earnings are going to want to get the dirty laundry out towards the end of the month. That's what we'll be occupying our time in the month of March. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, well, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.